This is the founder of the United Empire, Will Ospreay, the man that has done it all in New Japan Pro Wrestling, and you are listening to The Wrestle In.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the February episode of the Purovision podcast. I am your host, Jamie Johnson, and alongside me this month, the ever-dedicated, he's watched all the matches on the list this month, unlike myself, Fuser. How are you?
I'm good. I went even a step further. I was watching Stardom before we were recording.
That's the wrong podcast. You need to have a word with Trent if you want to get on the Stardom podcast. And as well with us, we have our resident Dragon Gate expert, Kay.
Hello. I'm very tired, but I'll do my best.
That's it. Everyone seems to be. It's been a very long month, this one, and it's only the 21st of February at time of recording. And there's been a lot of wrestling to watch and a lot of wrestling to catch up on, for me at least, as I came round and I was, oh, it's time to record the podcast, find some matches that I need to watch. So lots to talk about. But before we talk about any actual matches, there's a few talking points, obviously, and it's no prizes for guessing what we're going to talk about first, and that is the situation with Kazuchika Okada. It looks now that he will be going to AEW. That looks like the destination for him. I know we talked a little bit last month about where we thought he was going to go, where we wanted him to go, but it looks like AEW will be the destination for him.
There are a lot of jokes that we're in some ways lucky that this is the destination, because like it means he'll be able to at least partially keep living in Japan and his wife's fans won't go completely haywire. But like on a less joking note, it is kind of like, I personally, like I'm not super invested in either of like the big American companies, but I guess like in the end, AEW is for my money, like still a place I'd rather see him, just like if nothing else, because he'll still be able to show up in other promotions with like, you know, some certainty.
Yeah, and also, it makes the most sense, right? Like, Okada is really close to the Bucks. All the feuds he had with Kenny, so there's probably some relation there. Tony Khan is definitely not shied away from talking to him and putting him over. It just makes a lot of sense for Okada to go to AEW more than anything because, well, he's not going to get repackaged in AEW or have to deal with having to be in NXT for 6 months or something. But like, he's going to come in, he's going to get a huge pop, he's going to get put into a big feud, and then he's just going to be world champion by the end of the year.
I do think like the one thing I'm worried about, I don't know if I mentioned that last month, and with him going to AEW is like AEW already has not enough TV time for the talent they have. Like they have a lot of really fantastic talent and they don't have enough time to really showcase all of it. And like Okada, right? Like if you get Okada, you're not going to put him in a side role. Like he's going to be, as you said, like he's going to occupy an important position. And like, I am kind of worried, like whose time is going to get cut short for this, basically, right? Like, because you're going to cut someone's time short. And it's, it's always a little bit sad for me. Like, when I see, again, like, someone like Takeshita and how he's, you know, often kind of faded into the background over the past months. Like, I don't think Okada will fade into the background, but I think other talent will.
No, definitely not. It's a situation of, in my opinion, if Tony Khan keeps making these kinds of moves and signing more of these kinds of like bigger names that are going to be in these kind of spotlight positions where you're going to have to like push other people off the shows, do something with Ring of Honor. Get Ring of Honor into a more prominent position with like a TV deal and something. So then they have another brand that they can go to if they're not being used on AEW rather than being stuck behind that paywall. On Honor Club.
No, that would probably, you know, be some kind of solution that would at least help with that. Yeah,
I think it's an interesting one from sort of my perspective, because I watch more AEW than I watch WWE, and I'm going to that AEW show again in London in the summer, and on like it's really swings and roundabouts for me, because on the plus side I get to see him live, you'd imagine, at that Wembley show. and he'll have better matches probably in AEW. But on the negative side, it's not really fresh because there's not many people in AEW that he hasn't wrestled or that are interesting. Like, I mean, he's not wrestled Adam Copeland, but does anyone want to see Okada versus Adam Copeland? Adam Copeland probably does, but no one else does.
yeah, so the matches.
Well, I don't know what to say to that, because I really don't. I hate Adam. Adam Copeland was not Adam. Anyway, his matches with Christian were good, but I'll save that for a different podcast. The only win I can really think Swerve, because that's sort of fresh, and maybe Samoa Joe. But apart from that, there's nothing really that fresh with him. I guess that was the positive with him going to WWE, was that it would be fresh. But I feel the matches will be better in AEW, and for my watching of the two of them, I sort of dip in and out of AEW and don't watch anything really from WWE, then it's probably the best solution, if not that exciting.
See, I disagree with that, though, because AEW has so many partnerships with other promotions that we can end up seeing matches we wouldn't see. He's wrestled a bunch of guys on the roster already, like Kenny, Ospreay, Hangman, etc. But there's a lot of guys that he's never had one-on-one matches in, like CMLL, DDT, TNA. They probably won't work TNA. Like, there's a lot of more options here. Yes, if he goes to WWE, the only person there that he would have really faced before is like Nakamura and maybe Ricochet. But after a while, though, then he's going to kind of go through that cycle of like this. He's already faced all these people before, right? While with AEW, like he will have ended up facing a bunch of people. But over time, though, AEW will get more people in the company and also will have those partnerships with other promotions that we can see those kinds of matches, like matches like Okada Mystico, Okada Mascara Dorada, Okada Hechicero, more guys from DDT, like if they bring like Yuki Ueno, for example. It's just a thing of like there's, because of partnerships and everything that Tony Khan does, there will be more opportunity for there to be more matches. And also there's going to be guys on that lower end of the card that he's going to want to push at one point, and they will probably end up crossing paths with Okada, like Nick Wayne, for example.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, really. That's an interesting point with the fact that they've got more partnerships and it sort of brings in different people. You've swayed me slightly there, Fuse, I have to say. It's one of them. Maybe I'm a bit more apathetic to it. Now I've like come to terms with the fact that he's leaving Japan, that I'm less fussed in a way that which one he ends up on. But it does look like it will be AEW, so it'd be interesting to see by the time we record next month if that has happened or if he's already turned up. But someone we know for sure that is going to AEW is Will Ospreay. Over the weekend, he wrestled Michael Oku in Rev Pro, and Tony Khan was in the crowd cheering him on. And we saw that a few clips coming out of there, and he cut a nice promo afterwards, sort of thanking Tony Khan for the, I guess, the security that he's given him of being able to sign him down to a long-term contract in AEW. So we knew Ospreay was leaving for quite a while, but his last match has now been and gone. It was the Elimination Tag, the big 5-on-5 with Bullet Club, War Dogs, and the United Empire. Fuser, what did you make of that match?
Oh, holy shit. Hanari, are you okay? Clark Connors, are you okay? Gabe Kidd, are you okay? Is everyone okay? That's that's my main concern. Is everyone okay after this one? Very violent, very like literal blood feud. A lot of great miniature stories like TJP at the Aswan, Akira and the Fork, this like David Finlay kind of having to like prove himself more as a leader here, because there was going to this match a lot of people that weren't really behind him as a leader. So this was a good match for him to show that he has that killer instinct to be a leader of Bullet Club. The whole thing with Callum Newman just locked up on the outside and just every now and then getting just kicked at by Bullet Club members entering the match. And it was just absolute chaos. Handcuffs. I at one point thought that they were just going to handcuff each member of the United Empire around the cage and just like have that final shot of Osprey versus the War Dogs, but like have them just kick the shit out of him for a good like 5 minutes before they end up calling it. But they only handcuffed two of them, which was a bit of a shock to me. My one concern though is the floorboards. When they tore up the mat and it was like they're doing all the stuff on the floorboards. New Japan, please invest in plywood. Instead of having actual floorboards, invest in like proper big plywood boards if you're going to do more of these spots in the future, like how WWE has them. Because yeah, those floorboards that aren't at all connected to each other are just, it's not going to work, and that was dangerous. I think Coughlin actually tweaked his knee on that one, like, I'm blanking all the moves called the pile drive, the pile driver.
I don't know what you did call it, but some sort of pile driver, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like the pile, like the jump off and like help, like the pile driver. It's not a spike pile driver. I mean, I'm blanking on what the name of it is, though. I think it might be a spike pile driver. But like, and like his foot went through the boards and you could see him holding his knee afterwards. That was scary. That's something like that was a bit concerning about that. But other than like the one little mishap of those floorboards and everyone being very scared to work on them after seeing them pop up a few times, everything else about that match was really good.
Well, I think they should have thought about that before they took the canvas away, didn't they? Those floorboards are fine when they're not just the floorboards. It's like the whole point is that it's got the padding above it. So maybe the problem there was that they didn't fully think it through. I mean, it worked as an idea. It's sort of like you mentioned with the handcuffs, that it was everyone was being taken away from him one by one, and then even the ring was getting taken away from Ospreay. I guess that sort of worked as a nice visual. And I mean, maybe I'm just a bit more unbothered, but I was. There were some nice spots came from it. It did look. It was a bit strange as it was just popping up and down. It looked like Gabriel Kidd was going to fall through it, but he didn't in the end. Go on.
My concern was less of like just of like it. It was like, oh, like this is dumb. It was more of a concern of someone's going to get hurt. Someone is going to end up.
I don't
like,
think it going, was thought through properly.
No, if someone's going to end up going through the boards and like getting like actually hurt, that's what I was more concerned about than anything.
Yeah, on the match from sort of my perspective, and I seems like something I say a lot, but it was just too long. But I've been thinking about it since, and when I watched it, and like since I've watched it, and I don't know if it is a match. I feel like it's more, I guess I don't need to call it an experience. It sounds all like cinematic, but rather than being a match, it was more of like a spectacle. I understand where all the positive reviews are coming from, and I do agree with most of what you've said, to be honest with you. And I think it had some nice moments, but it was moments rather than it being a match. And I feel if I'd have known going in it would be an hour long and this is what it would be, then I would have probably enjoyed it more. But watching it, I was like, I had time to do so much. Like, I had it on, and then I made some food, then I had a drink, and then I did this, that, and because it was like there was nothing happening for sections of it. If they cut it down, it would just be a wonderful, like a really, really amazing hardcore match, because they had all the great spots you want from a hardcore match. And they went that extra step with stuff like the thumbtacks and the floorboards being exposed and that sort of thing. So if it was sort of like trimmed down, I feel like it would be a great match. But as it is, it's a nice spectacle. And maybe that was all it was meant to be, that it was a send-off for Ospreay in a sort of like a cathartic moment, as he had that match with Okada the other month in America. Maybe that was the send-off match, and then this was the send-off spectacle or send-off moment for him, with all the storylines being tied up with Akira and Newman and everyone being there. I understand where all the positivity is coming from in terms of the actual wrestling that was in there. It probably wasn't one that was for me, but I really enjoyed parts of it, and I guess the overall story, if I didn't like the execution, I liked the overall story.
Oh yeah, and like with that match, if you just take away the whole War Games aspect at the beginning where like everyone enters in like 90 second intervals,
yeah, that was really unnecessary.
Yeah, you remove that part, that's like 20 minutes shaved off the match right there, and then
nothing happened.
yeah, I like war games. It just kind of didn't really work in this situation. I think it would have been better if they just started with everyone in the ring. You get rid of that part of the match, though. That's like 20 minutes shaved off because Ospreay and Finlay went for 5 to start. Yeah, like about 20 minutes shaved off. And then from there, it's like a 40-minute match, which is much more like palatable.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with that. And one match that was a lot more palatable for me, I wanted to see what you think about this one, Fuser, but it was the match that came before is Zack Sabre Jr. against Daniel Bryan. And this is Bryan Danielson, I beg your pardon. This is my match down to a T. I absolutely loved it. And before I sort of go on and on and on about it, I'll see what you think about it, Fuser.
Yeah, this is my match of the year at the moment. If you've ever heard me talk on any live stream or any other podcast, really, or even just spoke to me in the last 6 months, you would know that I went to Wrestle Dream back in October. So I had seen the first one in person. That match was already incredible. This one, like, went up an extra notch. Like, it was somehow more technical. I was waiting for them to like maybe even recreate the spot where they were like on their heads slapping each other like they did in Wrestle Dream. Never recreated that spot and ended up being more brutal with the strikes. It was more technical. It was more stiff with the striking. And just the way it ended with Zach tying up Bryan and gaining the pinfall victory, basically setting up a third match because he went against his own, like, he's a bit of a hypocrite here because he called out Bryan after Wrestle Dream for winning with the Psycho knee and a pin, and then here he is not winning with a submission in this one. So it sets up what appears will be another rematch, a rubber match, which hopefully is only submissions. That would be fantastic, submission match. But yeah, just all overall, like, definitely match of the year for me at the moment.
Yeah, it's up there for me. It's one of the ones that are sort of flirting with the top spot so far. It's interesting, like you said, with the rematch, because they, was it ZSJ? One of them said that it should be on neutral ground, didn't they?
I think it was Zach that said that, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm maybe it's just because I'm overly excited and hoping that this is what it's going to be. I'm hoping it's either at Wembley, because you can sort of swing that as neutral ground as it's Danielson's promotion, but Zach's country, or even better, the night before the Rev Pro show in London for like All In weekend. So that's the dream. I know some people are saying maybe it'll be in Mexico, which again, that would make sense. So I'm really sort of intrigued on that aspect of it. And they've set that up beautifully, like you said, with the two pinfall victories sets up a submission match, or at least a submission orientated match. To finish the trifecta.
I would genuinely be surprised if it's on Rev Pro. That's like, with all due respect to Rev Pro.
No, I don't match think it's on Rev Pro either.
Yeah, with all due respect to Rev Pro, that's a match you put in front of 70,000 people in Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, that's what I'm expecting it to be on Wembley, but you never know. We can dream. Maybe they'll just stick it on Ring of Honor, probably in front of like 2,000 people in some sort of
go back chef. To the Universal Studios in Orlando.
Oh, yeah,
only like 500 people.
TNA. But yeah, also on the match itself, just quickly, it was the physicality was unbelievable. If anyone hasn't watched this match, it's the match to watch from February. It was the kicks and the stomps and sort of like the slap exchanges and the chops and everything was just unbelievable. Everything sounded fantastic, and it's a nice venue they're in for this one, and it's everything reverberates round, and it's that really helped. And yeah, really powerful stuff with the striking and the physicality that they were working into it. So it was right up my alley and one I absolutely loved. The other match to talk about from this show is Okada's last singles match in New Japan, as he faced Hiroshi Tanahashi. It was, I described it as sad in a few ways, in that it was quite slow and difficult, the sort of the work in it. And there was a few boos for Okada at the start, and they sort of fizzled out towards the end, but he seemed really taken aback by it. And I think at this point in his career, Tanahashi just unfortunately sort of like a shell of his former self. And maybe it's time to transition him away from these sort of matches. Maybe that's why it was so low down the card. But it was a nice moment and a nice sort of like last match, last hurrah for Okada against the person he's had the most history with in the company. But sad in a few ways, as well as sort of the emotion of the whole occasion. But the match itself was just pretty sad when you reflect it on what they have done in the past.
Yeah. I just gotta say, I'm very annoyed that this year Ospreay's been on a losing streak and Okada's been on a winning streak, and they're both out of the same company. Like, what is Okada yelling all the time backstage? That doesn't work for me, brother. Like, what's he doing? What's the secret to never having to put anyone over on his way out? Yeah, this was. I don't think anyone expected, like, you know, that same Rainmaker shock match from when he first came back from Excursion all those years ago. But it was definitely a lot slower than I would have thought it would have been. It was expected a bit with, like you said, like Tanahashi's kind of like with him aging and everything. It's kind of getting to that point that he's just like downhill and it's showing in his in-ring ability, unfortunately. But yeah, it wasn't terrible. It was not their best match they've ever had one-on-one. But I gotta say, it was surprising though that Okada won with just one Rainmaker. He didn't have to hit like a bunch of them like he does, like he has been doing over the years, or last few years. I mean, he just hit one and that was it.
Yeah, it was maybe an interesting one at that point, but it was a nice moment, wasn't it, with him kissing the logo in the center of the ring afterwards, and you could see how emotional it was. I mean, he was in absolute floods of tears at the end, and a nice moment, even if it's fizzled out. He's done a few 4 versus 4, 5 versus 5 tags in these last couple of weeks, and what's the point? Why can't that just be his final match? But alas, his last match in New Japan was a 5-on-5, second from the bottom, with Matt Riddle in it, but it's just the way that the booking goes, I guess. But
this is how Gedo was like, oh, you're not putting anyone over on your way out? Okay. Third on the card. Last match, yeah. Second on the card. If you're going out, you're going out at the bottom of the card.
Yeah, it was an interesting choice. But anyway, a multi-person tag team match that has got much better reviews than those ones we talked about with Okada there is one from Dragon Gate. And I see the authority as we head over to Kay's wonderful Dragon Gate corner, because we had some wonderful stuff from February to talk about.
Yes, indeed. And I think I'm going to start with the one that... that I know neither of you have watched, but that I thought was the best Dragon Gate match of the last month, and that was the elimination match between Natural Vibes and Zebrats on the 7th of February. And like I rewatched this match a couple of days ago for this podcast, and like the second time watching it, like even knowing everything about how it was gonna end, like I still got excited. It was really good. Like, it played into the larger story, right, between Natural Vibes and Zebrats, who are kind of, I think, in current day Dragon Gate, sort of the core rivalry of the promotion, right? You've got the heels and you've got the underdog baby faces. And in this match specifically, it was part of like this sort of story where Zebrats had like apparently gained a new member, like a masked member. And they sort of implied through various ways that it was like actually a Natural Vibes member who had secretly betrayed them. And in this match, it was sort of all to be revealed. And they at the very end, when they were about to lose the match, they brought out Maxi and Natural Vibes, the last person in the match, Kamei, got distracted, and Natural Vibes lost the match because of that. And I think this sort of the sort of through line of Amazon after the match, it should get this out of the way. It was, in fact, revealed who the person under the mask was, and it was a trainee who hadn't even debuted yet. And it was basically all a trick, sort of, by Zebras to sort of sow discord within Natural Vibes.
It was a ruse all along. It's me, Austin. And... it was me all along, Austin.
But I think the way that it, like this could have been like a total dud, this reveal, but the way that it worked into the story, like was sort of foreshadowed by the story of the match, I think was really, really expertly done. Because like towards the beginning of the match, Natural Vibes really had the advantage, and they had the advantage not because like of superior innate strength, but because of their teamwork. Like they worked together really well, they were prepared. But then like over the course of the match, you sort of saw that teamwork slowly disintegrate. Like the first big turning point was Kamei accidentally hitting Strong Machine J, was like the most fiery and the most easy to set up set off, I mean, in the group, with like and getting him eliminated. And you know, that then the whole distraction getting their team defeated altogether. I think that was really interesting setup. And then of course, like after the identity of the new member was revealed, Strong Machine J really went off on the rest of his team, because like he'd already been kind of struggling because he hadn't really won anything since he joined Natural Vibes, and he's like a real sort of, you know, achiever in that sense. Like he always wants to sort of strive upwards, and he through those circumstances sort of blew up and revealed that he was ashamed of being in this faction, was sort of so easily confused and so weak basically, and stormed out on them. That's sort of really interesting, I think, their way of combining both like the story within a match and like the story that happens after the match. I think that's sort of in wrestling fandom, the storytelling and the in-match stuff is often seen as, or talked about at least, as completely separate. Like, which one do you like more? But I think in this match it was shown very well, right? Like the way you can integrate both of those and make them work with each other. So I'd really recommend, like, if you watch no other Dragon Gate match this month, watch that one. That was really, really good.
Yeah, I'm disappointed I didn't get around to watching it, actually, because you sort of talked about it, didn't you, before, and it sounded great, and I was like, I'm going to watch it, and then I got to this morning and I was like, oh, I've not watched it, and I just totally forgot, so it's one I'm going to watch. But yeah, it sounds fantastic, and there's a couple of other bits, weren't there, from the end of January as well?
Yep, we had the very first instance of the Gate of Bayside pay-per-view, or not pay-per-view, like a big event, which is, I think, like a good choice sort of to establish new big events in new venues. Like that event took place in a new venue, and it was recently built up, because of course, like many older or more traditional wrestling venues currently are sort of closing up shop. All of that, like you may have heard the rumors, so I think it's kind of good to sort of start establishing alternatives. But I will say, I think one thing they kind of screwed up with the new venue was like the lighting setup. I think the event did not feel as big or as impressive as it could have, because they basically went with like natural afternoon lighting instead of, you know, the more classic big event wrestling lighting they also normally have. Yeah, I think that was kind of a detriment to the atmosphere. But other than that, I think there were some pretty good matches on the show, and I do think it's worth watching. I don't regret watching it. What did you think, though? Like, I recommended specifically the Twin Gate match and the Dream Gate match from this show. What did you think of those?
Dreamgate one. So this, I was a little disappointed in the Dreamgate one, just because like it felt lackluster for the story going into it between Louis Monte and Shun Skywalker. It felt like it was gonna be a much, you know, like there's been a lot bigger spots and stuff because it was such a big like feud that's been building since like Kobe World. That when I watched the match and it just didn't like click for me as in the way I thought it would. Still a good match. I still like would recommend watching it. I just was a bit underwhelmed. Also, I've like during that match I connected Shun's like sheep laughter with the laughter that Hiromu Takahashi does in his music, and now I just can't unhear it. It's like perfect. Like if you like take Shun's laugh and like just put it in where Hiromu laughs, it would be basically the same. And now I can't unhear that.
Well, those two should definitely wrestle each other sometime, but yeah. But yeah, I think like they are in some ways kind of two sides of the same coin, I do think. But with regards to like expecting the match to be bigger, and like I at the time kind of felt somewhat similarly, although I was like more emotionally invested than you probably were, but like for me in hindsight, I think what it kind of was like I was expecting, and most people from what I've heard were expecting it to sort of be like a super important point, like a climax match basically of that storyline, when it ended up more being like a build-up match to a larger story that's going to happen down the line, like with from how the wrestlers posted about it afterwards and stuff like that. It's kind of like I do think they could have handled that better, sort of to make clear in the story that like that's what it was gonna be, you know, instead of making it sort of seem in the build up like this sort of big moment. And I think then, like in that case, I think the beginning of the match was a bit slow, but like the back half was really good. Like in the match itself, right, there were some like really awesome spots in there. As you said, it's definitely worth watching just for some of those. You may have seen like a gif of of Shun like flying halfway across the ring when moonsaulting onto Manta's knees. Some awesome stuff, but again, I think the build didn't really fit. So Jamie, what did you think about it?
I thought it was fantastic because I definitely watched it.
I'm sorry for embarrassing you.
What was your favorite part?
The start.
After I just said the start was slow.
Well, I really love a slow start to a match. I mean, that's well documented. But I mean the end, that blew my mind as well. I mean, the start, the middle was fantastic too. I mean, it had everything.
I too enjoy neck cranks and sheep laughter.
I mean, it's the sheep laughter that did it. That was the...
I would actually more so say it's goat laughter.
It's bleating. It's just bleating.
Is there anything to come in March for Dragon Gate K?
I was going to also mention, like, briefly... No, before that, the Twin Gate match was also really good. I think like Alejandro is a guy who, even though he's a Noah wrestler, fits in actually really well with Dragon Gate style. Like he did really, really well in this match, and Kiyomiya also did great. Like considering that, as far as I know, Kiyomiya and Alejandro aren't exactly like an established tag team, and they did a really good job in this kind of tag team matches, and you know they probably also weren't the original intention for, you know, winning the championship, just kind of happened because the, you know, original plan got injured. But that was really interesting, so it's gonna be kind of fascinating to see, since they actually retained in this match somewhat unexpectedly, who they're gonna build, you know, for Rede Parejas to sort of challenge them after the tag team tournament. That's, you know, the next big thing that's gonna be coming up for Dragon Gate. And Dragon Gate tag team matches are always pretty interesting. So, you know, I recommend tuning in for the tournament, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly.
I can give you thoughts on Alejandro that are informed this time. Because we've seen him in Noah a few times, and he was... I don't think he's teamed with Kimia because he was part of Kenno's Congo faction. So,
mm-hmm.
But he was. I've always thought he was quite good. Maybe he was quite underrated. They used to flip him, flop him around in Noah. Didn't really do a lot with him. So it's nice to see he's sort of getting a bit more of a spotlight and getting a... He's got a title, hasn't he? Like you said, in Dragon Gate. So, I mean, that's a positive. Because I think he's really good. Every time I've seen him, I've been like pleasantly impressed by him. So yeah, hopefully Dragon Gate's the place for him because he never seemed to really work in Noah.
In that case, maybe you should keep the title a little longer.
Nothing seems to work for anyone in Noah, really, but we'll talk about that. I've got some thoughts, Noah-related thoughts, in a little bit. But before we get there, we've got a couple of All Japan bits and pieces to talk about.
I'm going to actually really quick. He was never in Congo.
He was. What faction was he in then?
I'm
pretty sure he was in Congo.
I'm not seeing it. Like, I'm looking at Cage Match right now. And
he, they used to rename him all red. The time. Yeah, that's in my head. He wore red. That is literally the reason I've said he was from Congo.
Yeah, he wore red before Congo dissolved. Now he wears green. So he had to have been in there.
He was never in Congo. I'm looking at Cage Match right now.
Cage Match is sometimes wrong.
Yes, he is in Congo. He is in Congo. When he was Aleha, he didn't have the Alejandro. He had a different name. He was in that big LIJ versus Congo match at Wrestle Kingdom in 2022. That the Wrestle Kingdom extra show they did in Yokohama. He was on the Congo team.
So Aleha was in Congo.
Yeah, but it's Alejandro. The same fella.
Yeah, sometimes, like, I do think that's also important to note for our listeners. Like, Cage Match and Wrestle Wikis or whatever can be a useful resource, but sometimes they get shit wrong.
He just checked, because he changed his name a few times, didn't he? I think maybe that's
probably
was the
confused someone there.
But I'm happy to say I got it right. I usually get that sort of thing wrong because, like, my memory fades me, but that was. I'm happy we've got that one. It's the red. You just remember him wearing all red with like the mask and the suit and everything. but in All Japan, a couple of Triple Crown matches to talk about. One from the end of January we'll talk about first, which was Nakajima against Shotaro Ishino. I quite liked it. It was all right. It was a solid main event, even if it didn't reach sort of like the next level that I was hoping for. And I came into this with like really, really high expectations because I love both of them. But I remember Nakajima's, he had a really nice armbar towards the end of the match, and that was probably the highlight. And it was quite physical, it was fairly hard hitting. So I was disappointed it didn't reach my expectations. But if my expectations weren't as high, then I probably would have enjoyed it more. But I still thought it was a really solid main event and a Triple Crown defense.
Yeah, I am not super like as familiar with Shotaro Ishino as you are. So I didn't go into this match with like your same expectations on him. But it was definitely a good match. Like I do agree that it was enjoyable main event, good main event. Definitely it left more to be desired, I guess would be a good like the correct term for it. Like if Ishino challenges again later down like later this year, then I would be down for it. I feel like there's just like more that these guys held back a bit in this match, just because like I don't know why they held it back, but it just felt like that there's kind of just like more that could have, you know, it could have been a little bit more.
Yeah, no, that makes sense actually. And it was I feel that might have been it, really. Maybe they are holding back for another title match. I'm not going to complain if that is the reason, but yeah, it was missing something, like an extra level, but that they've got in them, this pair of them. I mean, you said you're not very familiar with Ishino. Ishino is someone he's been a highlight of All Japan for me for a couple of years now. And he was him and Ryuki Honda, they're sort of like the two on the sort of the lower side of All Japan. But there was another Nakajima title defense. They're becoming a fixture. We seem to get one every month, which is great, and it's becoming a nice title reign. And we'll talk about that in a second. But the match was from the 20th of February. He defended, he was meant to defend against Rei Saito, who pinned him in a tag team match, but he's got injured. I think it's his arm. So he fought Jun Saito instead, and it was 20 minutes, like just shy. Very serviceable is how I described it. It was exactly what it needed to be to reach the standard level of Triple Crown main event title match. And yeah, didn't really go above that, but didn't go below it either. And it sort of did the job, especially for someone that they were inputting into the match. I thought it did the job. And my highlight to pick out, like I picked out the armbar in the last one, there was a lovely triangle towards the end from Nakajima, and the way Saito fought through it for what felt like a couple of minutes and then lifted him up for a janky looking powerbomb. But that was really nice. And the stretch was great. Like the finishing stretch was fantastic. And it sort of, it brought it up a little bit. And it was, made it a decent match, I thought.
Yeah. Dropped Nakajima right on his shoulder with that powerbomb.
Yeah. I was a bit worried. I dropped him out on his shoulder. I was like, oh God, you're dropping on his back instead of having his shoulder.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a good like showcase match for Jun Saito and what he can bring to All Japan within the next like couple of years or so. He's not there yet. I think him and Rei just kind of need to stick with the tag team work for a little bit longer, get more used to working together, and also and just kind of being in the ring as a whole. They're still fairly new to wrestling general. So it was a good, like, kind of like, hey, like, this is like what like Jun Saito can do in the future, but he's definitely not ready to be champion yet. The Rei Saito injury was super unfortunate because it happened in a tag match for the Nippon Senfidth anniversary show that took place on the 9th of February. That was garbage. It was against Timmy Thatcher, Saxon Husks, Huxley. They had one match. It went a minute 50 seconds, ended in a double countout. They restarted the match. It went 8 minutes and 50 seconds, ended in a double countout. And just what's the point?
You've summed up Noah there. What is the point at the minute? It's sort of all a bit dozy.
Yeah. The injury happened when it was super freak accident injury. Like he just like did a top rope splash onto, I think, a Saxon Huxley, and I guess just the impact of the splash just broke it, or not broke, tore something in his shoulder or something, which caused the injury. But so it was super freak accident. But it's just kind of a thing. It was like this was a match that just could have not happened, and we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, it's one of them in that you've got to protect people when they've got a title match coming up, and if you've got a title match in 10 days and it's your first one, I mean, why sort of being in a match like that in the first place? But
yeah,
it's one of those. It's an accident, like you said. So can't say I've seen it myself, but you said it was an accident. Don't. I mean, there's nothing you can...
Don't see it.
There's nothing you can really do.
It has Saxon Huxley. Don't see it.
Yeah, no, I've not. I can't say I've seen him wrestling. It's a real shame for me because I'm a massive, massive Timothy Thatcher fan. And I don't watch his matches at the minute in Noah because he's got Saxon Huxley following him around and it doesn't do anything for me. But something that I am excited for is the next Triple Crown defense. I've not got a date to mind, but it is Yuma Anzai who is the next challenger. And I'll see what you think about this, Fuser. But I'm really, really happy about this because of what we talked about last month with Fuchi's retirement show. And Anzai got the big spotlight and beat him in that main event. He won the Battle Royal, beat him in the main event, blah, 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 blah. It was a great spotlight for him, a great moment. And I'm so glad that they've capitalized on it because I think you get companies sometimes that will do a moment like that and then there you are. Look, he's made now, but they've given him the title match, which is fantastic, I think, because he's got it now and he can go to the next level. I don't expect him to beat Nakajima. I don't think he should. But it's the next step for him to go in his progression, and I think it's fantastic. I'm really happy that he's the next challenger.
Yeah, 100%. So initially Nakajima actually called out Suwama to be the next challenger, but Suwama didn't answer the challenge. It was answered by Yuma Anzai, which I would like to see Suwama versus Nakajima at some point, but I'm very all for Yuma Enzai challenging first before him. There is not a confirmed date as of right now, but All Japan did announce that there will be a Dream Power Series show on March 9th, and there will be Dan Tamura versus Rising Hayato for the All Japan Junior title on that show. So I'm thinking that will be the next defense. That's the hope, at least, that that will most likely be where that next defense will be taking place, is on that show.
I suspect it'll be in March, yeah, at some point anyway.
Yes. But yeah, no, Enzai is great. This would be good for him because around this time last year, or not around this time last year, it's a little bit later in the year, but he did challenge Yuji Nagata when he was champion at the time, and that was a very good kind of showcase match for him to be came put up against such a large, like, well-known and more respected veteran in Nagata. This will be like the kind of the same boat with Nakajima, where he's going to get a chance to have another showcase, but with a younger talent like Nakajima, who has experience but is not, like, you know, at the same level experience as Nagata. So it can show, like, kind of like he can keep up with the older generation and also the newer guys that are more around his age and more around, like, their prime compared to him. So I'm super excited for this. Bring on sooner rather than later.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with that. Like I said, I mean, I think it's the right next step. And I mean, the Suwama match doesn't do too much for me, but I don't think it'd be awful. I mean, it's Nakajima. It can't be too bad. Just before we skip on to the last thing we've got to talk about, which is a little bit of Noah, it's worth mentioning a couple of matches on the same show as the Nakajima Saito match on the 20th, the first day of the Excite series. Fuminoru Abe challenged Dan Tamura for the junior title. That was really worth watching. Some really nice submission work in that. Really enjoyable. I mean, I'm a big fan of both of them, so that was probably why I enjoyed that so much. But a match worth watching. And then a one a little bit earlier in the show, 10 minutes, really tight 10 minutes, fast-paced, energetic, and just full of cool spots. And that was the Aoyagi brothers against Miyahara and Rising Hayato. One thing I wanted to ask you about, Fuse, I feel like you might have something to say about this, was in this match, Kento Miyahara accidentally, with really aggressive inverted quotation marks, bumped into the referee and knocked him down. Nothing really came of it, but I sort of watched that, and I know you talked a little bit about that he was working heel in a match earlier on in the month that unfortunately we're probably not going to get around to talking about, but Is it a really slow burn heel turn, do we think, or is there nothing to it?
I think it's a slow burn heel turn. That, like, two different incidents where he did something very heelish. I wouldn't be surprised if this is kind of a slow burn heel turn that turns into something where we get a heel Nakajima challenging, heel Miyahara challenging Nakajima at some point for the title again. Because it would make sense if he's mad enough, like, if, like, it's just the fact that Nakajima, like, he lost to Nakajima in July, he lost to him again in December when he challenged him for the title, and Nakajima kind of just waltzed into All Japan, won the championship, and has held it ever since, claimed himself to be the new Tokon spirit and all this. So it's just, like, that frustration and anger is boiling over for Nakajima, or for Miyahara, that, like, he's, like, maybe that it's just getting to that point that he's going to turn heel. But it's two very isolated incidents. The 8-man tag where he was working heel, or sorry, the 6-man tag where he was working heel for that Nippon TV 70-year anniversary show. That was more him. He was teamed up with Ryuki Honda and Dan Tamura. So he was just more working heel of that match. So at the time, I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was a fun little thing to see Miyahara be a bad guy for once. But then this happened in that tag match, and it's kind of like, oh, maybe the two are connected. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, especially since they are him and Yuma will be having to have a tag match against either what were the two teams? Either Enzai and Honda or Suwama and Hideki Suzuki to determine who will be the next challengers for the All Japan Tag titles.
Well, I'm glad we're in agreement because I saw it and I thought maybe this is the start of a slow burn heel turn for him that will sort of bring a different element to a third match with Nakajima. So I'm glad you agree with me on that. I think that's one to keep an eye on. I think that's really interesting. And it's an interesting direction. Add something. I mean, you could give me Miyahara and Nakajima tomorrow and I'd be like, great, this is fantastic. But you can give me it in a few months' time with a different dynamic, with a heel Miyahara against Nakajima. It's something different. It's something fresh. And I think that's probably the best direction. And I think that's where this is going. I'll peg my flag to the mast really early and say, we've got a heel Miyahara on the way.
Yeah, for sure. It feels right too. I'm not super familiar with the history of All Japan, but it seems like Kento's never really had a proper heel run.
Not as far as I have seen All Japan for now. So I think it'll be an interesting one to keep an eye on at the very least. Last but not least, then we'll move over to Noah for their GHC heavyweight title match this month that came on the 4th of February, crossover in Sendai. And to my shock, Kenno is no longer the GHC heavyweight champion. He lost the title to El Hero Del Vikingo. You see, that's the hope, that's the dream. El Hero Del Dr. Wagner Jr., unfortunately. As you see, I was talking about Vikingo yesterday, see? But yeah, El Hero Del Dr. Wagner Jr. is the new GHC heavyweight champion. Before I sort of complain a little bit about the match itself, what do we make about the decision? Because this really took me aback when I saw this.
Shocked. Yeah,
I think it's kind of interesting because the decision comes I wouldn't have expected it, of course. And also, I think it's kind of interesting, right? Like, he's, I think, the first Mexican champion they've had. And this decision comes not long after, they did it in December of last year, after Dragon Gate got their first Mexican, main champ. So it's kind of like, and they're, right now both concurrently the main champion. So it's kind of interesting to see if there's gonna be a larger trend in Pro Wrestling or if it's just gonna be a case of I'd have two nickels, but it's weird that it happened twice in this case. But yeah, I go on.
No, sorry, I was laughing when you said sorry.
No, sorry. Yeah, but it's kind of interesting to me. To which I, of course, have to mention that Dave Meltzer was like, oh yeah, and he's the first Mexican main champ of a major Japanese promotion. I mean, Luis Mante became champion in Dragon Gate 2 months ago, but they're a small man's promotion.
Damn.
What did he mean by
even, it's like, even though they get bigger crowds, it's the...
Meltzer, Barry, and Dragon Gate. Jeez.
I think the only thing I can imagine is that it's because they're not owned by a big corporation. But yeah, I think in that sense it's very interesting. I'm kind of curious what they're gonna do with this. If they're gonna maybe build on it. I don't know. It's like, to me, this is both. I mean, something that I am kind of ambiguous on is, right, that while Mante is someone who I think should be built more as his own character, what is the case with him is he's in a new faction, he's got a faction buddy who can sort of talk for him most of the time, and sort of they have a common mission statement, at least they have a storyline going on currently with them trying to recruit Kamei from Natural Vibes. So it's kind of interesting to sort of compare that to sort of how Wagner's role in Noah is gonna look over the next couple months.
Yeah, this is like definitely a shock. Like, I don't think there's a lot of people that expected Kenno's reign to end so soon, especially to Wagner. I don't like, this was definitely the weakest defense out of every of like the all the defenses that Kenno had, as champ with this reign. It's still a solid defense, of course, but it's definitely not like his best. But it's interesting how much like pressure and notoriety people are putting onto Wagner being the first Mexican world champion in NOAH, because it's like, well, of course he is. There's only been two foreign world champions in the history of NOAH, and one of them's Eddie Edwards. So like, it's not really a high bar to, you know, get over there with Wagner being the only Mexican champion. But it's interesting to see like how NOAH is putting their eggs into the basket of Wagner as like the second ever foreign world champion, especially after like recently with how recently he lost the GHC national title. It's seems like that they are just kind of trying something, because they haven't gotten the best criticisms so far this year with everything that happened at like the New Year show, and then like the catchphrase stuff between Go and Kenno, and then like some other booking decisions going around. So it seems like they're just kind of like seeing like, hey, like people really like Wagner Jr. Let's put the belt on him and like just see where we go from here.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Really, it seems like they're just sort of throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks. I mean, it's a weird decision. I mean, maybe it's just because I'm not a massive fan of Wagner Jr. And I know people have sort of turned a corner on him in the past few months, the past year, and they've sort of come round on the side of that he's a pretty decent wrestler. For me, this match was just like the most average title match I've seen in a long time. It was Jake Lee-esque how average this was. I mean, I hope Ben's listening just for that. But
oh, hey, speaking of Jake Lee.
But it was just so there was just no urgency. It just didn't click for me, because there was no urgency. I didn't feel like it felt like there was filling for time. Like they were told it has to go half an hour, and they were like, right, we've not got half an hour's worth of wrestling to do. We'll sort of pad and fill for time. I mean, if it was cut down a little bit and sort of everything they did was tighter, then probably it's a better match. But it felt really dragged out and slow and trudged along at times. But the decision's an interesting one for me to give Wagner the title. I think, like you mentioned, it's sort of been made a big deal that he's the first Mexican champion. Maybe that to me says that NOAH are trying to pull on that audience, or maybe expand in that direction, or at least sort of create a connection with a Mexican audience. And that's an interesting thing to do. It sort of sets them out from other promotions in Japan. And if maybe that's the direction they're going, then maybe that's why it's happened. But he seems a lot more popular than he was maybe a year ago, Wagner. So maybe that is just the reason they've given the title. He's a bit more popular, chuck him the title belt, see what happens. But I think it's a sad one for Kenno. He's only just been made the champion and off he goes straight away. It feels a bit pointless. It seems to just be hopscotching around this title, and we've not got a long reign for a decent bit of time now. And just sort of maybe that's symbolic of where NOAH is at the minute. It's just a little bit of a mess, a little bit confused. They don't know if they're coming or going. They're just, a lot's happening and none of it really seems to have too much meaning. But they really need to turn a corner, I think, NOAH. And it's disappointing because last year, the year before, NOAH was great and I really enjoyed watching NOAH, and it seems to have just slowly and sort of fell off a cliff slowly, if you can fall off a cliff slowly. That it's a weird one for me, this, but I'm willing to see where it goes, because maybe there is sort of a reason behind it, like I said, with maybe a Mexican angle.
Yeah, for sure. And his first challenger, just because Jake Lee heard that Ben left Pure Vision, Jake Lee decided to come challenge and be the first challenger. Just out of spite.
I mean, Jake Lee versus Wagner Jr. fills me with confidence. I mean, that is a match for me. I mean, I've never wanted to watch a match more in my life.
If there was ever a match to make you fully confident in Wagner Jr., it's against Jake Lee. While we were in the vibe of complaining, can I loop back around to New Japan for a second?
Yes, I was going to throw you back to that, Fuser, because I know you've got some takes on the New Japan.
Yes. Why is Chase Owens a champion in 2024? Just why? Why is he a champion 2024? Why is Kenta and Chase Owens the IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team Champions when you could have just had them not be? You could have just not had this happen ever. This match could have been very avoidable by just simply not booking Gato. But here we are. At first, it was just going to be, oh God, I have to suffer through to Kenta and Chase Owens versus Hikaleo and ELP matches. Then it became, oh God, I have to suffer through to Kenta and Chase Owens versus Hikaleo and ELP matches, both for titles. And now it's, oh God, I have to suffer through a Kenta and Chase Owens title reign. But the main question I have is, if you were going to give Kenta and Chase Owens titles, why would you give them the IWGP heavyweight tag titles when you could have given them the strong openweight tag titles? You know, the titles that no one gives a damn about. You could have had, you know, the more worthy, prestigious titles that could be defended in Japan by people who, you know, want to be there wrestling in ELP and Hikuleo. But instead, we're going to be stuck with Chase Owens and Kenta being champions for God knows how long.
I think calling the heavyweight tag titles prestigious is maybe that's a stretch.
They're more prestigious than the strong openweight tag titles. I mean, have you seen the strong openweight tag titles?
I don't know who the strong openweight tag titles champions are.
A lot. The most prestigious champions that have held those titles is Aussie Open and Motor City Machine Guns. Anyway, your main titles in New Japan, or main tag titles in New Japan, and instead of keeping it on the tag team that the people wanted to see, they put them onto Chase and Kenta. And this isn't even like a thing where with the House of Torture, there's the argument of like, oh, like there's the Western fans who despise the House of Torture and think the House of Torture is absolutely garbage. But like they're one of the most popular things going on in Japanese wrestling over in Japan for the Japanese audience. When Kenta and Chase Owens won the titles with Ishimori's interference, dead silent. Not a word. Yeah. It was dead in Osaka. That is not a reaction you want to have. It is not 2020 anymore. You do not want the crowd to be silent.
Yeah, no, this is the problem I'm having with New Japan at the minute. They're just sort of weird. This is my problem with wrestling at the minute, actually. We'll expand it, because Noah's making really weird decisions. DDT haven't really done anything interesting for a while, and New Japan just keeps shooting the ends in the foot. And Chase Owens, like you said, he should not be a champion.
Kenta, I mean, neither.
You can argue he shouldn't be there, but Kenta, maybe that's a... Kenta, at this stage in his career, probably not the grandest idea. There's better options, but I think he'd be perfect, like you said, for the strong. Get him over in America, where there's a bit more of appeal for him.
Exactly. But, and the thing is... Sorry, the thing is, with like the strong openweight tag titles, with them being in America, that also benefits Kenta more, because Kenta's the Defy world champion. So he will be able to defend the Defy world title more, because he'll be in America more with the strong tag titles. But now he's going to be stuck in Japan more, because he has the IWGP heavyweight tag titles. So there's going to be less defenses for Defy. So this also kind of doesn't really work in favor of Defy.
They'll probably just give the titles back in a month anyway. That's what they tend to do. But Kay, have you got any other business before we sign off for the month? Any rants you want to get off your chest?
Is Dragon Gate doing something stupid that you need to talk about?
No, I'm like, again, I mentioned before, right? Like, I do think they should build that match better, and I think they should get better lighting for that big event next time. But other than that, I don't really have any complaints about them right now. Like, they've, I was worried that they weren't gonna continue like the Kamei storyline after sort of the end of last year, but they're continuing that now, and hopefully they're gonna set up something good for Dead or Alive this year, because like they haven't had cage matches at Dead or Alive for 2 years now, and that's like the whole gimmick of that event. So hopefully they're gonna have one this year.
Maybe we just need to be a Dragon Gate podcast. There's nothing to complain about in Dragon Gate. Maybe that's what we need to
do. Dragon Gate is perfect.
This is where we're going wrong.
Well, probably not perfect, but yeah. It is like, yeah. But I don't have anything. I figured I had some sort of small nitpick, but I've forgotten it now. So, yeah. So it must be perfect.
That's it. Well, before we go, Fuser, have you got anything to plug, and where can the listeners find you?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at FuserBalor, and this episode of Pure Vision will be coming out a few days after our most recent episode, Tone On Stop Talking. On that episode, we discussed the firing of Scott D'Amore from TNA, we did a review of Sacrifice, and we just did a whole bunch of other talking just about TNA, and we didn't stop.
I like a podcast that does what it says on the tin for you, isn't it? That's fantastic. Kay, how about yourself?
I am currently balancing several interviews, like two of them currently in progress, and maybe one or two more that I'm planning to follow up on. So maybe one of those will be out by the time this podcast goes out. Probably not, though, because like the main one I sent the questions for is like a really, really big one. So, you know, look forward to that in the future, probably. But if nothing else, we have an excursion interview with Machizuki Jr. out on 5starnetwork.co. You can check that out. It's, you know, very simple, very approachable, comes with a little bit of an introduction in case you don't know much about him. And yeah, so, you know, have a look at that. And that's, I think, about it for this month. And oh yeah, I'm working on my biggest article yet, a Dragon Gate roster guide. So maybe that's going to come out by the end of the month. Maybe it's going to be early next month, depending on how much work I can still get in.
Fantastic. And for me, you can follow me on Twitter at jjohnson_16. I'm working on, like Kay, not as much as Kay, but I've got a couple of installments I'm working on of my Keeping Up With The Indies series, a few in the pipeline for that, and lots of other stuff, but it's, everything's on my Twitter. I've been a busy bee these last couple of weeks, but wrestling wise it is the I've got a few on the way on my Keeping Up With The Indies sort of stream of things. So thank you everyone for listening. Follow wrestling on Patreon, or subscribe, I guess this is probably the right word. patreon.com/wrestling is your link for that. You get into the Wrestleverse every weekend, Noob Japan TV early access, and all the great things that come along with that. Search Wrestle In wherever you listen to your podcasts, for as well as ours, all the wonderful podcasts across the network. And we will be back same time, same place next month for another episode of Pure Vision.